Welcome back, everyone. Today we're going to talk about OCD. This is a topic I'm pretty excited about. For some reason, over my short span as a therapist, I've had an unusual number of patients with OCD, so I do have experience treating this, and also just general experience getting to know this disorder, what it's like for the people who experience it. So I can go ahead and tell you that 1.6% of the U.S. population has had OCD during their lifetime. It can happen from adolescence to young adulthood. And you know, things that this is commonly comorbid with are anxiety disorders. Makes sense because OCD is, you know, has anxiety basically at the center of it. So people with OCD are somewhat more likely than others to also have social phobia, so social anxiety, specific phobias, panic disorders, and other sorts of anxiety disorders. So Kibby, kick us off with the diagnostic criteria of OCD.
Yeah, I'm also excited to do this topic because it's something that I've assessed a lot in my grad school and now starting to do the treatment. It's really cool because especially the treatment is super effective for this. It could be such a distressing and debilitating disorder, but the CBT treatments we have for it are so, so good and effective. So the way we assess, especially from the perspective of the DSM, is OCD is a disorder marked by either obsessions or compulsions. And when I say obsessions, I don't just mean like you think about something a lot. It's like a thought or an image that keeps popping up, almost kind of like a loop, like the same image pops up over and over again, or the same thought pops up over and over again. So it could be something like, if I don't check the stove, someone will die. Or it could be a picture of if I touch dirt, my whole family dies of contamination, right? It's sometimes these really alarming thoughts. And then those thoughts, those obsessions are really distressing, really upsetting. And it's not like you have this thought and you enjoy it. It causes a lot of distress. And that's important because then people engage in compulsions. So people tend to suppress the anxiety or kind of get rid of the anxiety and distress with doing something else. Whether it's avoiding something or checking or some other kind of ritualistic behavior, right? So OCD is marked with either obsessions or compulsions, but they commonly go together. And the thing that I find interesting is that you can have varying levels of insight about this situation. So a lot of people know that these thoughts might be crazy or weird or don't make any sense. For example, you know, some people know that touching dirt won't kill their whole family, but they'll still have that thought. So there's a part of someone's mind that goes, come on, I know this is not likely, but still that thought causes a lot of distress and they have to do something to get rid of that distress. So it's interesting because it originally was considered an anxiety disorder and now has moved to thought disorders because the thoughts and the beliefs around it are so nonsensical. Like they don't kind of map onto someone's reality.
Yeah, I find OCD absolutely fascinating. And it is an important distinction because when you treat something like generalized anxiety disorder, the intrusive thoughts are what we call egocentric. So the person, you know, might believe in them. They relate to them. They really feel like they're coming from them. Like, oh yeah, this thought makes sense. It feels like me that's saying it. OCD thoughts are more likely to be ego dystonic. So it can be like, where is this coming from? Like, where are these thoughts coming from? They don't make any sense to me, but they're still just intruding in my brain every day. And they're so loud and anxiety provoking that I have to do something about it. So it can be very confusing to a person with OCD to have these thoughts. And actually, you know, I think what often comes to mind when we talk about OCD is like the cleaning compulsions. So contamination, OCD, you're worried about germs and then you wash your hands constantly. I think that's the sort of platonic view of OCD that we think of. I've mostly treated something a little bit different where it's more of a mental compulsion. And the thoughts can have to do a lot more with identity. So these thoughts coming in that say, well, what if you're not really who you are? What if you're somebody different? What if your sexuality is different? What if what you want to do for your life, for your career, isn't really what you want to do for your life? And so you can see that sort of ego dystonic process going of like, wait a minute, I think I know myself. I've been acting this way my whole life, but these thoughts are coming in that maybe everything you think about yourself is wrong.
Yeah.
And that is really disturbing.
Yeah. I mean, you're getting into this cool area that there's actually, you know, common different subtypes of OCD. Mm-hmm. So not all OCD looks the same. One is a big one that you mentioned, the contamination and washing and cleaning. Like if mm-hmm. I touch something, I'm going to get ill, right? And that is... that with the pandemic, let me tell you, first of all, in the beginning of the pandemic, people with that kind of OCD were so happy because now the reality fit that their neuroses, right? Like if I touch something, if I touch a doorknob, I will die or my whole family will die. That's like, you know, that's what we were learning at the time. But another subtype you mentioned is like compulsive thoughts, right? Mm-hmm. Who am I? Sometimes prayer or counting or mentally checking. Sometimes it's just, you know,
yep.
These compulsive thoughts are in your mind. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of cool to think about that identity could be one of the mental subtype. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what you mentioned about COVID is interesting because you and I have both done assessments of OCD and I have heard this repeatedly of people saying, you know, on the one hand, you'd think that I would be more distressed because there are more germs to be worried about. But on the other hand, I'm suddenly feeling a lot more normal because I'm not the odd person washing their hands 60 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Everyone else is doing that too. Suddenly everybody else is taking after me.
Yeah.
And that can be immensely validating and also could be kind of a problem because you don't want to validate the compulsions.
Right. Or the obsessions. Yeah, especially with this pandemic piece and the contamination, it is tough. I think that the way we would mark someone who has like OCD and it's a problem versus like the response of the pandemic is how impairing it is in their lives, right? Like with all the disorders we talk about, it's supposed to interfere with either your ability to take care of things at home, your ability to maintain your relationships and work and stuff. With people who have like contamination OCD, they're washing their hands or doing or thinking about it or getting distressed for significant parts of the day, like hours a day, or they're washing their hands to the point where their hands are chapped. Mm-hmm. They cannot possibly touch dirt and not wash their hands for long periods of time. So it's kind of this, it like locks them into this, it feels kind of like their own prison of having to do this thing. Otherwise they can't go on with their day. Other kinds of subtypes that are cool to think about is causing harm or checking. So this mm-hmm. is a popular one where someone has to check the stove or if they lock their door, sometimes a specific number of times, but sometimes it's over and over again because they have the thought, if I don't check my door, someone is going to break in and burn down the house or mm-hmm. or steal everything. Or it can be like, sometimes they're afraid of themselves harming other people, right? People who have had no history of violence or doing anything to hurt someone else are afraid of being around knives because they're afraid of stabbing someone they love, right?
Yeah.
That's like sometimes an obsession where they picture themselves hurting themselves or hurting someone else. And they're like, oh my God, I would never do that. I don't know why I'm having that, but I'm too afraid to go near knives to, you know, just in case.
Yeah. Right?
So that's another subtype.
One version of this that has been increasing in prevalence is social media checking with the idea that they start really getting very, very worried that they've said something on social media that could offend other people, even if they haven't posted that day.
Hmm.
So they'll start compulsively checking all the social media, making sure nothing was posted, and then that still won't be enough. So I'll check and check and check and check and check and check and check.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, sometimes like that, the actual obsessions might be something that's likely, right? Like that mm-hmm. they might have done that. It sounds like, and that's trickier when the obsessions are something that's possible mm-hmm. because people then go, I don't even want to risk the slight possibility that this could happen. One example, actually, I haven't experienced OCD. I'm more of an obsessive compulsive person in general, but I've never experienced like full blown OCD except one time, the few times that I've been on fertility meds, There's a particular fertility med that I went on. I'm not going to say what it is because not everyone has this experience. So I don't want to freak people out. But every time I would take it, I would spend the entire day with the obsessional thought that I'm going to throw myself into traffic.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was like, and then it would switch throughout the day that I would hurt myself in some other way. But it was a picture that kept coming up in my mind. I have never done that before. I've never had those thoughts before. I, you know, I know myself well enough to know that I'm not suicidal like that. But I had these really vivid pictures of me throwing myself in front of a car over and over again. And I would be sitting there like treating patients, doing my job. And I just had to distract myself hard enough to kind of get that thought away. And it really freaked me out because there was another part of my brain that was like, whoa, Kibby, that's crazy. Like, what is going on? But then it really helped me see what it's like to have OCD. It feels like there's like another part of your brain that's like an alarm system going off over and over and you can't hit the off button.
One thing I've seen with some people with OCD is that they'll have like a main obsession compulsion system, but then there will be sort of touches of other things. Like when they cross a bridge, they have an image of throwing themselves off of the bridge. And it's not because they want to throw themselves off the bridge. It's just a feeling that like, wait, what if this happened? Or the need to, or the feeling like I'm gonna throw my phone out the window. It's just kind of odd, you know, these odd little thoughts that only come up in certain circumstances. But because the OCD brain, I mean, it might have like a primary fixation. It's still processing in this way in all sorts of contexts in life, and so these little kind of things can crop up. Sounds terrifying.
And luckily it went away when I stopped taking the medications, but it could be terrifying to the person because you could recognize it as something that pops up, but then there's another part of my mind that was like, what if I do it, you know, like what if I do it, what if I'm walking next to on the street and I just do it, you know? So there is this kind of like, luckily, like I didn't have this, but some people believe that those thoughts might come true. And that's where the distress really can jack up. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm just imagining this, there's this part of you that doesn't trust yourself, maybe like, oh, you know, I don't seem like a person who would throw myself into traffic, but what if some part of me just decides for me anyway. That kind of goes along with the identity piece. Like, I think I know who I am, but what if I don't know who I am at all? And that would just be so unnerving to live with every day.
Yeah. And how much do we identify with our thoughts? You know, every time our thoughts come up or the things that we think or the things that we believe, how much do we identify with that? Right. If I spend my whole day thinking about throwing myself in the front of a car, that's going to, you know, that's going to put my sense of self into question eventually. But at least that was my experience. It would be really interesting to know more about people's identity and OCD.
That is a good point, though. I mean, a lot of times the way we construct our identity is based around the things that we think about a lot. And the things we think about a lot give us clues into what we love and like and or are afraid of. You know, like if I think about Paul all the time, it probably means that I'm in love with Paul.
Right.
Well, so what about somebody who thinks about something unpleasant or fearful all the time? Well, then how do you kind of code that?
Yeah, I've seen the most amount of questioning themselves around some people who I've seen have OCD around molestation. They will have the obsessional thought or picture in their mind, the image of molesting a child or some kind of sexual abuse or something. They're like, I would never do that. And then it gets alarming, right? They're like, how could I have these thoughts? Like, what does that say about me? So, and often, you know, just for people listening, if you ever experienced that, I mean, that is one of the hardest things for people to admit to a therapist, right? Because then they get so scared that a therapist might, you know, get worried or concerned about risk. But often those thoughts come just from erroneous stuff, from just, they just read something in a newspaper, they watched something on TV, and they were stressed at the time. So it's not these obsessions don't think is coming from this like inner self. It could be just something that you heard recently, and you know.
Yeah, I mean the irony is somebody who has those obsessions might actually be the person who is more compassionate towards children, because it's so horrifying to imagine doing this to a child that that's what creates the obsession.
Yeah.
Like, how could this ever happen to a child? Well, like, then, and then you start obsessing about it. And then you start turning into somebody who worries that you're going to molest a child, even though it start, you know, in reality, that's something you find the most horrific.
Yeah. I mean, this is a shout out to anyone who maybe experiences this and like maybe so shameful or horrified about these thoughts. Like, please go get treatment, because just because you have these thoughts doesn't mean you're going to do it, or this is who you are. So just a plug for that. But the other common subtypes that pop up with OCD, one is symmetry, order, and arranging. So this one, I don't know, feels a little bit like OCPD, but it's it's when you have this feel, you need to arrange things perfectly or in a way, in a standard, like everything needs to be symmetrical, or dishes need to be lined up in a certain way. I remember someone had that. They needed to be lined up and organized in a certain way. And if not, they might not have the harm obsession. They may not think anything bad's going to happen, but they just, it doesn't feel right, right? But they just can't leave the room without making sure everything is symmetrical and right. Yeah. Otherwise, it's so much distress. They can't function. Like, they might spend hours rearranging things. And the other one that comes up is hoarding. So this is another subtype. Hoarding generally means people who have a lot of difficulty throwing away stuff that doesn't necessarily have sentimental value or can be useful. Things like newspapers or receipts or other kind of trash that they recognize doesn't have any value, but they just can't throw it away.
Yeah.
A lot of people have that. You know, whenever I assess people with that, everyone's like, yeah, I have trouble throwing things out, like old clothes and things like that. But it's a little like your house gets cluttered. Like
your house gets unusable.
Yeah. Sometimes, like with extreme examples, it's like there's some like TV shows about it where there's like newspapers piling up so that you can't even access your desk, or even in extreme cases, it's like covering your entire house. So that's a type of OCD. It's hoarding.
Yeah. And I guess I would say, if you're wondering about whether you have this or somebody else has this, I mean, this is like, if there are rooms where you can't get to the exit because it's so filled with stuff, or the bathtub is filled up with things, so there's something like pretty necessary that is now unusable, or the kitchen sink is filled. So if we're thinking about CBT, the way that we conceptualize OCD is that you have this neutral event that becomes associated with fear when it's experienced with something scary. And these neutral events can be thoughts, actual events, etc. And then you start kind of, I mean, this makes sense, right? Like, something scary happens and you escape it, and then that becomes associated with safety. So you begin to use escape and avoidance as a way to kind of neutralize the scary thing again. And then that becomes cyclical, where you're now constantly in this life where you're just avoiding. And that's where the compulsion can come up. To illustrate this, actually, I talked to somebody, one of my Instagram followers, maybe a year ago at this point. And I remember her story was that she had been molested at church. And so, you know, church was this neutral kind of stimulus, and then the molestation was the scary event, and it took place in the church. So then church itself became incredibly scary, especially because the perpetrator was somebody who worked at the church. And so every time she went back to the church, it was incredibly scary. And she kind of reimagined this church as, she developed a contamination OCD. You know, she felt incredibly violated and unclean during this experience. And so she began wiping down doorknobs constantly, wiping down everything in the vicinity of the church. And then this expanded into her home as well. So these things can then generalize. And her, you know, her parents had no idea what had happened. And so she was made fun of a lot, like, oh, that's just crazy Sally, I'm making up that name, but like, she's, you know, just wiping down the piano again, without knowing that actually this had been caused by a horrifying trauma.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a super good example, because often OCD does come up when there's something stressful happening, right? It's not necessarily, like, it's not a trauma disorder, but it usually comes up when someone is stressed or, you know, in a state of arousal like that. And the piece that is, you know, more of a thought disorder is that there's a lot of beliefs that are, that don't really map onto reality, right? That we call distorted cognitions, which I don't like the word distorted, but like, for example, safe situations are assumed to be more dangerous than they are, right? For her to wipe down doorknobs, it's like there's a thought there that if I clean this doorknob, I'll be safe from harm, right? Right. And then the other part is a thought reality fusion, they call it, where it's like, if I have these thoughts, it's real. Yeah. Right. If I clean this doorknob a bunch of times, I'm going to be safe. Or if I don't clean it, I'm going to be violated and contaminated again. So people can have awareness of how unlikely this is or anything like that, but there's still a part of them that's like fully believing it. So
yeah, this thought reality fusion is a real big problem. When you think about things like, for instance, relationship OCD, which is when, you know, you have a partner and you start suddenly, you basically start like obsessing over potential flaws or whether you really love them or whether you're feeling correctly about them, whether you're enjoying sex enough, etc. And the compulsion might be sort of to check your inner state constantly. What am I feeling right now? Am I feeling in love? Am I feeling in love? Mm-hmm. Am I feeling turned on during the sexual experience? Like, am I feeling turned on enough? This thought reality fusion becomes a big issue because, you know, once you start obsessing, you're going to see flaws and you're going to, you know, doubt your love. And all of a sudden you're like, well, if I'm having these thoughts that maybe I don't love them or maybe they have these flaws, well, then it must be true that I don't love them because somebody who's really in love wouldn't even have these thoughts. And so that can become enormously distressing and can really undermine your entire relationship. And, you know, another thing that happens is a lot of people talk about trusting your gut. You know, if you think something's dangerous, if you've got this feeling, trust your gut. You know, you got to listen to that. Well, somebody with OCD, trusting their gut is actually a really kind of thorny space to get into. When do you trust yourself? Because your danger response is going to be lit up all the time. You know, if you are worried about being, you know, if you're worried about a terrorist attacks, for instance, in big public spaces, and you go into a big public space and your gut is telling you, oh God, something bad is going to happen, something bad's going to happen, then you're probably going to avoid that space. And then no terrorist attack occurs. But, you know, this process keeps repeating. Yeah. And with a relationship, my gut's telling me I don't love this person. My gut's telling me there are doubts. Oh no, oh no. But really, that's just the OCD process.
Yeah. It's interesting too, thinking about the gut, because my one professor we have here at Duke who treats OCD in children, he says that a lot of his clinical experience that people feel it in their chest, like they kind of locate the feeling of distress in their chest because it kind of feels like guilt, right? If they don't, they kind of have that thought reality fusion. If they don't do something, something terrible is going to happen. So there's like this kind of guilt too, right? And then like distress around the guilt, but kind of feeling in their chest or kind of like their solar plexus where it's like, ooh, you know, it's just kind of squeezing there. It's cool.
Do you know if that's different than what people feel physically who don't have OCD, who are feeling something in their gut? Like, is that more in the stomach or?
I don't know, man. I mean, I think there should be way more research on like somatic experiences of psychopathology. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to kind of, I'm sure that research is really hard to do, but we hear it a lot in clinical work, but it's hard to pin down, but it's just a really interesting because like it's your body is reacting with different kinds of emotions, right? So
yeah,
I thought of another example of causing harm and checking. I really like this example. It really stood out in my mind. There is one person who her compulsion, her obsessive thought was if she didn't tell her boyfriend I love you every time she left the house, then he's gonna die and she'll never get to tell him I love him again. So she would have to every day have to say to his face, like, I love you. And she said, and I was like, does it get in the way of your life? She's like, yeah, because I can't leave the house until I tell him I love him directly. And then, if they're in a fight, the boyfriend would block her from doing it. Like, he would hide in a room or like put headphones on or block her text on his phone. And she'd be so mad because she'd try to tell him, but then she'd have to like leave work to come home or like turn the car around if he's not responding to the text, go home and say, I love you. And then go on with her day.
That's so evil of the boyfriend.
I know. Yeah, just really leaning into that. So, it's kind of a cute example. I'm sure it was really distressing to her, but the dynamics around it were really funny.
Uh-huh.
So a tip for the loved ones, don't abuse OCD.
Okay, well, can you tell us a little bit about the neurobiology?
Yeah, I'm not an expert in this. I just recently read a really cool a review paper on this by Graybiel and Rausch from year 2000, so you want to look that up. But basically, they found that OCD is really linked to abnormal cortico-basal ganglia circuit activity. Okay, I don't really know exactly what those are. But basically, that means there's disruptions in the systems involved in and deciding whether something like a stimuli is rewarding or punishing. So when you make decisions or motivated towards something, you go towards things that are rewarding and go away from things that are punishing, right? So systems involved in figuring that out are kind of something's, you know, off with them. Or systems that involve executive functioning, so decision making, and the cortical basal ganglia circuits involved in like habit learning and routine behavior, so these ritual behaviors. So that's kind of cool, like to think about the systems involved in, you know, figuring out what's good or bad and making decisions and like routine behaviors. So what's cool about that too is that apparently their recent research is looking into if deficits in each of these different parts can help determine what kind of OCD you have, right? So like people with repetitive motions like tics or who do like, you know, things over and over again, that might be in a different part of the system than people who have obsessions that who have like deficits in more the like behavioral planning and decision-making circuits. So it's kind of this like combined circuitry, but there might be different parts that are involved in, you know, like the obsessions or the compulsions and where you might have the deficits might determine your symptoms. So I thought that was kind of cool.
That, I mean, it immediately just makes me think of what are the implications then for medicine, for treating this with medicine.
Yeah. And I mean, you'll go into this in a minute, but what's kind of cool now is they have some research showing that with good CBT treatment, you actually see restored functioning in these circuits. So, so I don't know if you could, right now we could really target specific parts, but definitely treatment shown to actually restore that circuitry. So that's cool.
Awesome. That's super cool. Please send me that paper.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll talk a little bit about the treatment for this because it is a treatment that I am currently doing. And it's called exposure response prevention. So this is an incredibly straightforward treatment in terms of you figure out what the person is avoiding. And remember, these are all avoidance processes. You're avoiding the anxiety associated with the obsession. So if you're checking the stove 50 times a day, then, you know, you're avoiding the experience of leaving the house without the absolute 100% certainty that the house won't burn down. So you kind of figure out what they're avoiding, you expose them to it, and then you prevent the compulsion. That's sort of the basic of what the treatment is. This is a time-limited treatment, usually around 17 to 20 sessions that are around 90 to 120 minutes. It's very effective. So a meta-analysis that we looked at said that two-thirds of patients who went who undertook EXRP experienced improvement, and a third of those people had total recovery, which is pretty impressive if you think about something as severe as OCD. ERP or EXRP, same thing, is better than all other treatments. At least that's what we know so far from the science.
That's a super important point that you made, that exposure and response prevention is better than other treatments, because I have heard of other treatments that have actually made OCD worse. You know, I'm not usually the kind of person who goes, you got to do CBT or nothing. But in these cases, sometimes, for example, other treatments like, I love psychodynamic treatment, but some psychodynamic therapists have taken the thoughts more seriously. And almost what I see is like, make the thought reality fusion worse. They go, oh, you have these thoughts of molesting someone. Well, maybe that's coming from a subconscious wish. And then they're like, oh my God, you know, and so they take it more seriously. And it's awful, because then the OCD gets worse. And so I really, you know, if you're listening to this, you definitely look into exposure and response prevention, because that is shown to be like, is really demonstrated to be better than the other treatments out there.
Yeah. One interesting thing to keep in mind here is, again, going to the difference between something like generalized anxiety disorder versus OCPD, where the worries in anxiety for GAD, it's egocentric. And so it's really like you who's having these thoughts. With OCD, one thing I'll do is kind of make a ridiculous personification of the obsession, of the obsessional part of the brain. Either a dragon, a troll, a goblin, something like that. Because it really, the experience is like, there's you, there's your identity, and then there's this dragon that is just sitting on your shoulder, just like spitting these ridiculous thoughts at you all day long. And so if you can kind of create like a disconnect from that part, it can potentially be easier to know what exactly you're shutting down.
Nice.
And what to not believe in. And it's also just kind of like a, you know, make it ridiculous. Like this part is ridiculous. The things it's telling you are ridiculous. And so also having that distance can help you see like, oh yeah, it is ridiculous to think that I ran somebody over in my car coming back from work, and now I'm driving around the block 800 times. That is a ridiculous thing, because did I feel that happen? No. Is my car damaged? No. All the evidence points to no.
Yeah. I mean, you're getting into the, basically why all these treatments work, like the mechanism of change. Because how exposure and response prevention works, and even the technique you were talking about, like making it a dragon, basically it's breaking the association between these thoughts and the distress, right? That's kind of what you're kind of going with. It's disconfirming the disordered beliefs through exposures, like teaching them that these thoughts are not dangerous and there might be a low likelihood of whatever they're afraid of happening. But also learning how to sit with those thoughts and not necessarily do the avoidance or compulsions or rituals to reduce the anxiety. You know, you could still have the distress go down and still feel, so you basically change your relationship to those thoughts. You don't think, I have to do this compulsion. I have to check the stove. Otherwise everyone will die. It's like, oh, I could not check the stove and not everyone's going to die anyway. So that's kind of how this works. And I love the, you know, making, personifying it into something else, because it also does the same thing, like taking the power out of those thoughts, I think.
Right. Yeah. I'll sometimes say, you know, like throw popcorn at that dragon, like throw something stupid at that dragon, because it's not, you know, it's telling you something so stupid and you can just tell it something stupid right back. Like, I don't believe you. Just go away. Essentially what you do is you figure out an exposure hierarchy, and you kind of want to make this somewhat aligned to the person's values. So, you know, I mean, I'm going to give a pretty concrete example from a case study in a second.
What is exposure hierarchy? I don't know.
Exposure hierarchy is basically when you say, okay, like, let's say somebody is afraid of a terrorist attack happening in a public space. Well, you know, the last step probably in this hierarchy is like going to Times Square or, you know, some like super, super populated place and being there for a number of hours without checking. Well, that's like kind of a flooding experience. So you'd start smaller, figure out like what are ways that we can kind of work up to this big kahuna exposure at the end.
Right. So it's like a list of feared situations or.
Right. So you might be like, okay, you know, if they can't leave their house literally at all, then it's like, go stand in your front yard for 5 minutes or go, you know, downtown with a friend and then go downtown alone and you work up to it. I'll give a case study example of a kind of OCD that I actually am treating. When this is a sexual orientation obsession. So this is an example of a man who is married and he, I believe, has children, but he is plagued with these obsessions that maybe he is homosexual. And this, you know, can have like homophobic origins, but it can also just go back to that idea of like, wait, do I not really know who I am? Am I living a lie? Am I making my wife live a lie? Like, there's this part of me that just has this fear that maybe I'm lying to everybody around me, including myself, and everybody else knows it but me. And so the exposure hierarchy set up for him was, the first one was to look at men's pictures in magazines. So you figure out this guy is literally avoiding even looking at good-looking men or men in general. I remember for this case study, you know, he was afraid to be alone in a room with another man. He was afraid to have conversations about any kind of sexuality with another man or like any anything that could kind of clue people in or clue himself in that maybe he doesn't have a sexuality he thinks he does. So it starts with looking at men's pictures in magazines, then it goes up to complimenting a man on his appearance. Why? Because before, if he ever thought to do that, he would think to himself, maybe they'll think I'm gay because I've now complimented them. Watching a movie, in this case it was the movie Milk, have a conversation with another man about gay issues, then it went up to an imaginal exposure. So sometimes these exposures aren't something you have to do in real life. Sometimes they're just like, oh, you just imagine it. Like with phobias, you know, you have them imagine a big spider or something. This was having him imagine an exposure about a sexual encounter with another man. And you do imaginal exposure about the consequence of being gay. Then you watch Brokeback Mountain. Then he had to be alone with another man and converse. This goes all the way up to going to a gay bar and watching gay pornography. And then talking to various people, like talk to his own brother about his that brother's experience of being gay. So you can get fairly creative, and you can target a lot of these different pieces of avoidance. Like, are you avoiding being perceived by other people as gay? Are you avoiding like looking at attractive men? Are you avoiding talking to people about this topic? And you work your way up to the top. And the important thing is that you have to prevent the compulsion. Mm-hmm. This person's compulsion was sort of checking his physiology every time he was around another man. Like, am I feeling an increase in heart rate? Am I feeling turned on? And the irony is that maybe he is, because this thing is making him so nervous. You know? And so you really have to, like, prevent these checking behaviors.
Yeah, I think that's the key part. I mean, this all actually, it's the same thing with, you know, treating other anxiety disorders that we've talked about, right? Like, expose yourself to the fear thing and then prevent the problematic behavior you do to kind of reduce the anxiety, which in a lot of anxiety, like phobias, it's like the avoidance. Same thing here with OCD. It's like, there might be avoidance, like, I don't want to watch the movie Milk, but it mm-hmm. also could be like, I have to then Google something 8 times before, or like I have to check something over and over, right? So you have, the therapist has to stop the person from doing the thing. And it's, doing the treatment is kind of fun because it's really like behavioral. It really is like, don't do that. Just sit with that thought or sit with that situation until the distress goes up and then it goes down on its own.
Yeah. I mean, this can get, it's going to get really interesting with something like contamination. I mean, you could have your patient sit in the bathroom and eat a sandwich off the bathroom floor.
I remember I was working in a clinic where I just heard my friend who's a therapist taking a patient around, and she was like, okay, lick it. I was like, what's happening? And then I peeked out, and she was having her patient lick doorknobs because she had a contamination. So she's just sitting, like, licking every therapist doorknob. That's awesome. So you actually, like, being a therapist for OCD, it's actually quite fun. It's a very active, it's very like getting in their lives and doing some ridiculous things. Like, sometimes, like, I've heard therapists have their patients lick a toilet in a public bathroom, and then sometimes the therapist will do it too, just to, you know, really encourage the all-in approach. So it's, you have to be really brave to do it and to treat it too.
Yeah, I think that is important, is that the therapist ideally is willing to do these things too.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really powerful to show this person, like, yeah, I'm not afraid of this. You don't have to be afraid of this.
Yeah.
Or I'm not making you do anything that I wouldn't do. I'm right here with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, typically the experience is a lot of fear coming up to the exposure. But then over the time they find out, hey, actually this wasn't so scary. I was able to do this. And, you know, in this guy's case, I didn't turn gay. You know, watching Milk didn't make me gay. Like, it's okay to take in this media. It's okay to talk to other men and to compliment their appearance. Nothing bad, not that being gay would be bad, but like nothing that I feared actually happened.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because when I was listening to you describe that case, the common question came up that a lot of patients have, where they're like, well, what if it actually does happen? Like, mm-hmm. what if licking the doorknob will actually make me sick and die? Mm-hmm. What if I'm gay, right? What mm-hmm. if that guy was gay? And the way we explain it is like, I had this with one therapist who's brilliant, who said it's kind of, OCD is kind of like an allergy. It's kind of like an allergic response, right? Mm-hmm. You could be exposed to an allergen, but then your body flares up in this way that's like more problematic than the actual allergen, right? Like it mm-hmm. could actually like really interfere with your life. So that's what you're trying to target. You're trying to target someone's response to those thoughts and that likelihood, even if it's small and real. If someone's spending all day avoiding anything that could come in contact with them, their lives are going to be so small. And
yeah.
even if if that person was gay, like he can't actually explore it in a healthy way if he's constantly avoiding all these things and getting so like consumed with the compulsions, right? So it does kind of, yeah, that these things might happen, but can we get the coping around that likelihood
exactly.
of danger or situation be a little bit healthier?
Well, yeah, and that coping is just as important. I mean, if you get sick, you do need to learn how to take care of yourself when you're sick.
Yeah.
You do
yeah.
need to learn, like, yeah, sometimes I'll get sick and that's okay. Mm-hmm. If he does, quote, turn gay. Well, did he actually turn gay? No, he's always gay. And now he can,
right.
Welcome to the rest of your life, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, sometimes if these things do happen, then that's even more powerful because you mm-hmm. get to find out who you really are and what you're capable of.
I think the last point I make about this is I know that some people have questions about medications. Antidepressants like SSRIs have been found to be particularly helpful. But sometimes I was looking at the research. Sometimes people who are on medications will sometimes have like residual OCD symptoms, like the distress might go away a little bit or they might be able to handle it, but they'll still have repetitive thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So what they show is like when you have medication, the, CBT treatment, exposure and response prevention will actually help with those last remaining symptoms.
Yeah.
So just, you know, just for people to know that if you don't like the side effects of medication or if either medications or therapy are not available to you, both can be effective, but the combination is usually great, as with a lot of other disorders.
Absolutely. So Kibbe, what can friends and family do to help?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's like with anything, help them find treatment, right? This treatment, and I want to make another point. It is time limited. Usually this kind of therapy takes like 17 to 20 sessions, but I've heard of versions of this that could be in 4 sessions, someone could be cured. So
wow.
Please help your loved one find treatment. But another thing is, sometimes people, the loved ones will involve themselves and kind of enable these compulsions, right? Like, someone has a symmetry or OCD, so they might help that person make sure everything is in order mm-hmm. and, or they'll help them do the compulsions just because they know that it reduces the anxiety and it helps them go along with their day.
Yeah.
But with the help of a therapist, sometimes the loved ones are involved in really helping that person stop doing the compulsions. So to help them not avoid the situations or to not let them check, you know, the amount of times that they're used to checking, right? So yeah. Sometimes a loved one can be involved in the treatment in a really nice way and preventing the response, those ritual behaviors.
Yeah, and I guess the last thing would be, like, try not to take the thoughts that they're having super seriously and do basically what you said about psychodynamic treatment of, like, oh, well, you know, you're having thoughts about molesting a child. Okay, well, what did anything happen when you... I mean, maybe, like... I can understand having a first conversation to, like, understand that this is an OCD, egodystonic thing. Yeah. But once you kind of understand that, like, you know, not really getting into the content of those thoughts because it can just inflame them and they shouldn't necessarily be there in the first place. So
Yeah. So if your loved one has never hurt anyone or, you know, and it has never, there's no history of doing any of these, like, dangerous thoughts they might have. Mm-hmm. Like if they've never molested a child or never molested someone else or hurt someone else, then you don't have to go, oh, these OCD thoughts, now I have to be scared for my safety or their safety. It's like, as you're saying, like, don't take those thoughts seriously. Otherwise that person's also going to believe it harder. So,
yeah. So, Kiwi, do you have any resources?
Yeah, I mean, most of the content then we've been talking about today has pulled right from the Treatments at Work series. It's always our favorite. And you could buy a workbook online. Actually, I think there's some internet versions of this kind of treatment that's being delivered now, which is kind of cool. But the book that we're talking about is Exposure and Response or Ritual Prevention for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. And it is written by, Yadin, Foa, and Lichtner. So you could just, you know, go on Amazon, you could get the workbook, kind of read about it for yourself, and find a therapist who is trained in this kind of therapy. So.
Awesome. Well, I hope you all enjoyed learning about OCD and we will see you all next week. Also, if you do want to compulsively rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast, that would be an example of, an egosyntonic compulsion. So please do. Okay. We'll see you next week. Bye. By accessing this podcast, I acknowledge that the hosts of this podcast make no warranty, guarantee, or representation as to the accuracy or sufficiency of the information featured in this podcast. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast and any and all content or services available on or through this podcast are provided for general, non-commercial informational purposes only and do not constitute the practice of medical or any other professional judgment, advice, diagnosis, or treatment and should not be considered or used as a substitute for the independent professional judgment, advice, diagnosis, or treatment of a duly licensed and qualified healthcare provider. In case of a medical emergency, you should immediately call 911. The hosts do not endorse, approve, recommend, or certify any information, product, process, service, or organization presented or mentioned in this podcast, and information from this podcast should not be referenced in any way to imply such approval or endorsement.